So the topic of the talk tonight is compassion. Compassion in relation to the mindfulness of death practice. And, you know, just a kind of reminder that when we say mindfulness, it's our whole being. We can associate the mind with thinking, figuring out, but actually it's deeper than that. It's the awareness that pervades our whole being, which includes the heart. There, you know, as I was walking at night, I saw how beautiful the moon is and how bright, and it reminded me of something that happened to me when I was training here at Spirit Rock. I think Nikki does know this story because she was there when it happened. But we were training in a place in the same landscape, but just a few miles away, in a really crowded house. It was really hot and stuffy. And at the end of the day, when the sun was going down, a friend of and I took a walk on a fire road. And it was in the summer, and the grass was really tall, and the sky was really beautiful from the sunset. And in the grass, I saw these two little triangles, and I realized they were ears, and there was an animal kind of running through the grass. And I couldn't tell, because the grass was so tall, if it was a fox or a coyote, or how tall the animal was and how long the legs were. But, you know, like, about the distance of the altar, maybe even closer, there was a clearing. And into the clearing came this coyote. And he sat down while my friend and I watched. And he started to, like, stretch his neck and make these guttural noises. And it was just, I was transfixed. It was, like, so intimate and so clear to watch this wild animal, you know, just kind of stretching its throat and making sounds. And then the sun went down and the moon came up and the coyote started howling at the moon. And then all around, like in a complete circle, all these other coyotes answered and they all just started howling. It was extraordinary. And I remember thinking, wow, this would be great for a Dharma talk. But, you know, what's the point? What is the point? And I thought about that for a while. Didn't come up with anything until years later on a retreat. A yogi who was really struggling, I saw her walking at night, and she was smiling. And it's like, you know, what's up? And she said, oh, the moon is smiling at me. And I remember that the moon is a symbol in many Buddhist traditions for enlightenment. It's a symbol of awakening. And I thought to myself, oh yeah, all beings want to awaken, even coyotes. But, you know, according to the teachings, because we have a human heart and mind, we actually have that opportunity. We have the opportunity to awaken. This is one of the precious gifts that comes with having a human life. So I think what really attracted me to the Buddhist teachings, there were many things, but one thing was the recognition that in order to awaken, we need to train our mind. It just doesn't happen by chance. We have to train our mind to let go of habits that lead towards suffering and cultivate different habits, familiarize ourselves with qualities of mind that lead to happiness, to clarity, to clear seeing. What's also important is how we train our mind. So there's a really great documentary called The Path of the Horse. It's written by a woman who traveled around the world because she became disillusioned with her experience of being a horse trainer to study with master trainers. It's extraordinary to see. And one of the horse trainers said to her that there are basically two kinds of horses. There's a horse you can take into the ring where it's the same kind of, things required in that ring. It's kind of like it can repeat over and over again what you ask it to do, as long as what you ask it to do remains the same. These are horses that are trained with fear. But if you want your horse to be able to go with you in any situation, you have to train it with loving kindness and friendliness. And this is true of the mind. And we've talked a lot about the unpredictability of death, that we don't really know. We know it's going to happen, but we don't know when, we don't know how. So we have to train that whatever happens, wherever we are, we're a safe person to ourselves, to others, that we can depend on the mind to be kind, malleable, flexible, stable. This means we have to train the mind with compassion and love. You know, I thought about that story a lot that Bhante told about the sister and the brother and the regret that she felt for the rest of her life that those last moments together hadn't been loving. And, you know, it's often said, like, that compassion is the activity of wisdom. If she had known it was her last moment, if her mind had been wise to that, then of course she would have acted compassionately. And this is one of the benefits of practicing mindfulness of death. The felt sense, the deep realization that this could be our last moment really gives us a different relationship to that last moment. I wanted to share a story that I think really represents that, that coming to that realization that this could be our last moment. It's something I learned from a student who was a very active member in the Inside LA community. She was like the community photographer, so she was at all the different events. And she used to sit in a sitting group. Her name was Tracy Frank. And she sat in a sitting group that I led, and she was probably around early 50s, and she was a single mom, and she had a diagnosis that she was going to die, that her death was going to be soon. And she was a really wonderful, remarkable person, and she was very open about her dying experience with the people in the community, the people in the class. And in the class, we were studying the Bahia Sutta. And I'm sure some of you have heard the story of Bahia before. I really like this story because I really like him. And the story, I won't go into all the details, but was that Bahia was in a shipwreck. And he got washed to shore near a village. And his clothes had been taken off, you know, in the shipwreck, in the water. So when he got out, he kind of covered himself with bark and went into the town. And the people in the town thought he was a wandering yogi, somebody very wise, a great teacher. And they invited him to stay. And I kind of picture him setting up shop under a tree, and people would come and ask him questions, and he would answer. And but then he had a thought, you know, that maybe he isn't as wise as he thinks. And this is why I really like him, because, you know, he wasn't into pretending anymore. He really wanted to know. He really wanted to awaken. So it was recommended that he go and study with the Buddha. And I won't go through all of the details. I'm just going to give you the instructions that the Buddha gave Bahia. Here in Bahia, you should train yourself thus. In the seen will be merely what is seen. In the heard will be merely what is heard. In the sensed will be merely what is sensed. In the cognized will be merely what is cognized. In this way, you should train yourself, Bahia. When Bahia for you in the seen is merely what is seen, in the cognized is merely, you know, what is cognized, he goes on through all of them, then Bahia, you will not be with that. When Bahia, you are not with that, then Bahia, you will not be in that. When Bahia, you are not in that, then Bahia, you will be neither here nor beyond nor in between the two. Just this is the end of suffering. So we're talking about this sutta, and Tracy, who knew that she was going to die, raised her hand and she said, you know, I my view of this sutta has really changed since my diagnosis. When I first heard it, I thought, oh, I don't really like this teaching. It makes me feel fragmented, kind of annihilated. It feels kind of almost scary. But she said, I'm just going to read now, that she knew now that she was going to die, she had really let go. She'd let go of a future. She'd let go of her job. She'd let go of striving. And she let go of having anything to achieve. And now, when she hears those instructions in the hearing, just the hearing, in the seeing, just the seeing, in the feeling, just the feeling, for her now the experience is like going from love to love to love. The sounds, the sights, the people, the moments. And then she said, and I feel so much love coming back to me. And when she gave that teaching, I thought, wow, you know, I too had really kind of, there was something in the Bahia teaching that I didn't understand. It also made me feel a bit fragmented and seemed kind of cold. But then I saw it completely differently. And practicing in that way, you know, remembering like Tracy's teaching or imagining bringing that brother and sister, it completely changes what it means to open to the moment, what kind of legacy we want to leave in the moment. You know, we all know what it's like to have regrets, to have a sleepless night. Just you know, we're so sensitive. We just say like one wrong thing and it can, you know, we can't sleep. So this is why our training precepts are so important, why they're, it's said that they lead to the bliss of blamelessness, the bliss of no regret. And this is, I think, something that is really highlighted by mindfulness of death practice and why it's actually considered a happiness training. And you might not know it, but there is an app called We Croak. It reminds you five times a day that you're going to die. Yeah. And if you pay for it, you get even, you know, you get quotes, but if you pay, you get even more quotes. And I had that app, and it was really interesting. You know, at first, like, it was just kind of weird, but it started to, like, permeate my mind. I noticed, you know, when I would hear an ambulance or drive by a hospital, I was more awake to it, and it helped in the practice of sila, of ethical behavior, of non-contention. There was a period of time when I had the metta phrase, may I meet this moment, or may I meet this person as a friend. And it kind of changed for me. I started thinking, may I leave this person as a friend? May I be unburdened by contention, free of enmity, moment to moment. It's very profound, and it did make me much calmer and much happier person. So while it's natural, I think, for compassion to arise from mindfulness of death practice, we've seen it in this room. You know, the sharing of these deeper realizations about the nature of reality in our life does lead to compassion, but it also can bring up a lot of fear. And, you know, I've dealt with a lot of fear in my practice, and I was once at the Forest Refuge practicing and working with fear a lot. And one of the things that really helped me was going to the library and looking at a book about Mahabua, the Thai forest master. It was a picture book. And he had an incredibly gentle face. Like you could just by looking at the pictures, it was like, wow, what would it be like to be like that? You know, it was a reminder that this quality of heart, of gentleness and receptivity and kindness is something you can feel. You can see a picture and feel it. And it was a kind of teaching, you know, for me to just sort of merge my mind with his for a while and calm myself down. Kodo and I've been enjoying being with Kodo because of his Zen background and remembering some of the teachings of Suzuki Roshi. And one of my teachings that I love is that a student once asked him, you know, if I practice sincerely, will I get enlightened? And Suzuki Roshi, it almost makes me want to cry. He said, sincere practice is almost as good as awakening. You know, because that sincerity and authenticity of heart, those are moments of awakening. BKS Iyengar said that we all know what it's like to be awakened. We just need to make those moments come more often and last longer. And I always felt that was a very helpful teaching. So this is, Ajahn Buu's teacher was Ajahn Mun, a Thai forest master who was very influential. And this is what he wrote about Ajahn Mun. Acharya Mun taught that all hearts have the same language. No matter what one's language or nationality is, the heart has nothing but simple awareness, which is why he said that the hearts have the same language. When a thought arises, we understand it. But when we put it into words, it has to become this or that language so that we don't really understand one another. The feelings within the heart, though, are the same for everyone. That is why the Dharma fits the heart perfectly, because the Dharma isn't any particular language. The Dharma is the language of the heart. The Dharma resides with the heart. I think there's something to be said. You know, this is, to me, like a really profound teaching because we do teach and hear the Dharma in words. And our word, you know, our relationship to words is, it has to do with so many different things. I mean, one example for me that was, you know, that I think expresses this is the word patience. I remember, I was actually at our training, you know, we were talking about the Buddha saying patience is the supreme austerity. And I turned to my friend, I said, oh my God, I'm screwed. because I thought patience was like white knuckling it. I wasn't actually thinking about patience. I was thinking about agitation. I didn't even know what patience was, but I had an idea that I knew what it was, and also that it was just something I couldn't tolerate. As it turns out, patience has much more to do with relaxation and wisdom, the understanding that things that are worthwhile take time. Things that are worthwhile may fall apart before they come together. You know, I went back to painting after many years, and you know, to make a good painting, the painting has to fall apart. Otherwise, you're just kind of repeating itself. So what happens when it falls apart is really key. Do we criticize ourselves? Harsh? Oh, this will never work. You're such a screw-up. Why did you do it? Blah, blah, blah. You ruined it. Or do we have real wisdom and patience and can say to ourselves, things fall apart. You know, you're in new territory. There's something to be learned here. You can do it. You've done it before. Developing this compassionate voice for the ups and downs of practice is really a turning point in practice to actually learn how to relate to ourselves compassionately. There were two other words that I really had a lot of problem with, and those two words were letting go. I really didn't like when I heard people say we're supposed to let go. I kind of felt, you know, God, I'm holding on for dear life. I'm just trying to keep it together. Why are you telling me to let go? It felt like, you know, I was asked to stand at the abyss and jump. And it brought up a lot of fear for me, not release, not letting go. It actually brought up the opposite. But I heard this story about Bikesh Iyengar, who was my yoga teacher, and from someone whose mom was his student. And as a young man, he got to travel with Bikesh Iyengar. And there was a photo shoot, and he came along. And the photo shoot was like at the edge of the Grand Canyon of India, which is supposed to be like one of the windiest places in the world. And they photographed Mr. Iyengar at the edge of the abyss, with his back to the abyss, in a headstand. So this young man, when they were walking back to the car, said to Mr. Iyengar, how did you do that? And he gave this very terse answer, known, unknown. And what he meant was, when you're facing the unknown, focus on what you know. Focus on what you know is true. So this is a really good teaching, I think, for mindfulness of death. If we focus on true refuge, on our ethical precepts, on loving kindness and compassion, then letting go is a very different. You know, we were talking earlier at dinner. I mean, when the truth of the Dharma is true everywhere. That's what makes it a true refuge. So we can kind of count on that, count on the practice that we're doing to be with us when conditions change. There's a well-known researcher in compassion, Krista Neff. And she's done a lot of research on self-compassion, and she says that the qualities of self-compassion and compassion are really the same qualities, and that actually, you know, the research shows that people are able to offer compassion easier to other people than they can to themselves. So I'd sort of like to say, just to go over what she says compassion is, because I think it's very much in line with the Buddhist teachings. And she actually developed a program on mindful self-compassion when she was, the idea came when she was at the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. So it really draws a lot on our Buddhist tradition. So she said that the first thing that we need to have compassion is mindfulness. That in order to respond to suffering with kindness, we have to know we're suffering. We have to know that suffering's there. And, you know, there are sufferings that's obvious, and we do know. But what we're not so much aware of, because our mind is more invisible maybe to us, is the suffering that we're creating in our own mind. Bhante talked about that. Mindfulness is also mindful of the mind. So when we're really harsh and critical and judgmental, we may not see it. It's like we're a fish swimming in water. We don't see the water. It's always there. If we've practiced over and over again being critical and harsh, we may not be aware. So it takes mindfulness, kind of reflecting back, like, what is the attitude of my mind right now? How am I seeing this? Through what, you know, lens of mind? I used to have a house that the back door, it faced a garden, and there was an orange tree. And some days I'd look out and everything would be bright and the oranges were just looked so great and gorgeous. I grew up in New York. It was so amazing. And then other times it just looked gray, you know, just no color at all. And it wasn't the lighting that changed. It was my mood. You know, seeing through a kind of calm, clear, bright, you know, confident mind and a mind that was really critical and harsh, it changed the view. So mindfulness can help us to see which mind states create a view that helps us to awaken. It's really important to be able to do that. This is what Desmond Tutu says, the great South African peace activist. Much depends on your attitude. If you are filled with negative judgment and anger, then you will feel separate from other people. You will feel lonely. But if you have an open heart and are filled with trust and friendship, even if you are physically alone, even living a hermit's life, you will never feel lonely. Such a beautiful teaching. So mindfulness is the first aspect of compassion. The second aspect is kindness. That, you know, rather than meeting suffering with blame, cruelty, denial, we meet it with kindness and the wish to help. There's often it's said that, you know, the mind is big like a sky. So I used to think, well, my mind's a little bit more like a room. And it was helpful, actually, because I could think, well, what's in the room right now? You know, is it filled with anger? Well, if it's filled with anger, I could invite in other feelings into that. It was like opening the windows, opening the door, invite in other feelings like compassion, appreciation, gratitude. So I had this kind of concept in my mind when it was another teaching about suffering that I learned from a student. I think I mentioned I worked at UCLA in a pediatric pain program. I taught Iyengar yoga there, and we did Iyengar yoga research. And we were doing a research study on young people who had cancer who suffered from persistent fatigue. They don't really know. I also did a breast cancer study on persistent fatigue. And at the time, they didn't really know. I don't know if it's changed. Why? You know, it wasn't really about the treatments or there, you know. Anyway, so the research was actually highly effective. But there was a woman in the young person's cancer study who had lost her leg. And at the time, she wasn't able to be fit for a prosthetic. So, you know, it was really, just a heartbreaking injury. And she was a really great person. So she would come to, we met twice a week. I forget for how many weeks. And she learned how to do handstands and headstands and backbends. And she loved the practice. And then a couple of weeks went by and she didn't come. I was really concerned. I didn't know what had happened, because one of the things that you see in research studies like this is people want to participate because they want to give something back. And unless you come for a certain amount of meetings, then you can't be in the study. You know, it's like dose dependent or whatever to do the research. So when she did come back, I asked her where she had been. And she said, "Oh, my grandmother died." And then she said, and she was in the hospital where I had been for a year and a half. I was like, whoa. Like, I had no idea she'd been in the hospital for a year and a half. And I thought, wow, how traumatic. And she said, and she was in the room next to mine. I was like, oh my God, how traumatic. And then she said, so we asked to move my grandmother into my room because there was so much love in that room. So, you know, just a beautiful teaching on what we can decorate our rooms with, you know, the room of our mind and our heart. And that even in really, really difficult situations, there is still this great potential for love and compassion. The third aspect of, there's three, mindfulness, kindness, and our common humanity. That's the third aspect that Kristin Neff says you find in compassion, is the realization of our common humanity. Often what can happen to us when we're suffering, well, we're talking actually now about self-compassion. Often what can happen to us when we're suffering is we feel isolated. We have a lot of self-blame. We have a lot of shame. We think we should be doing it better. We don't realize, well, this is hard, you know. We think we're the only one who is struggling to be kind, struggling to show up, struggling to get out of bed in the morning. We think we're the only one. We don't realize at that time that there's millions of people who are in the same mind state as we are. And when we open up to that, there's just like, it's just, there's more space. We're closer to the truth. There's less blame. I really enjoy, there's one of the movies about Mr. Rogers, and there was something he said I really liked. He said that we're smiled into smiling, we're talked into talking, we're loved into loving, and I thought, we're dharma'd into dharma-ing. I don't know how you say that, but, you know, we're part of a lineage. And for some people, when we say the word lineage, you know, we have not a good, you know, we don't have good family relationships. It can sort of bring up a sense of inadequacy, actually. But in dharma practice, we also have a chosen lineage, the lineage that we choose to be our lineage, a lineage of compassion and kindness that's gone on for thousands of years. And to me, open up to our common humanity is also opening up to that, opening up to the support of our tradition. Sometimes when I'm really struggling, I like to feel like, you know, my teacher's hands are just on my back, or like Kuan Yin, like, has my back. Another thing that I would do sometimes when I was really struggling in practice is just imagine the Dalai Lama was practicing at the same time, and I just would kind of hitch a ride. You know, just like, oh, my mind is just going to merge with his. You know, that's something that we really can do, to open up, to support, to call on, you know, call on the Dharma for support, to open to our common humanity, our shared experience of suffering, and all the wisdom that's been passed down with generosity for our benefit. Bhante talked about hindrances, you know, the same hindrances that are there for mindfulness are also there for compassion and loving kindness practices. And one of them is doubt. You know, we feel like, really, is it really okay for us to practice self-compassion? Does that mean that we're selfish or we're self-indulgent or we won't have enough compassion for someone else? Remember the first time I heard Jack, I learned mindfulness, metta for self, the first time from Jack Kornfield. And I remember saying to myself, is that allowed? You know, like, is it really allowed to be? I thought, I would never get out of bed again if I was kind to myself. But that's really a delusion. And there's a story that's often told about, this kind of about self-compassion. And it's a story of a man who was in a grocery store. And he was walking down the aisle and he saw a mom pushing a cart with a toddler. And the toddler was going down like the cereal aisle and just wailing, you know, that they wanted like the, sugar-coated cornflakes. And, you know, and the mom was going, oh, don't cry, Monica. We'll be home soon. Put on your jammies, take a warm bath, we'll have a good meal. Don't cry, Monica. It went down the next level. It was the soda aisle. Monica starts wailing, and the mom's like, Monica, don't cry, you know. And it just went on and on and on. This man is watching this, and then they get to the register, and there's the candy. And, you know, he wants to be helpful. So he says to the woman, oh, Monica, she's such an adorable little child. And the mom looks at him and says, she's not Monica, I am. So, you know, it's like it's a good reminder that when we calm down, it really affects other people. You know, it's really important to care for ourselves. People, like, feel the energy of your capacity to calm yourself down. I've been talking about the gentle side of compassion, the kind of tender side, but there's also a fierce compassion. Fierce compassion is part of the Buddhist tradition, and sometimes I think in Tibetan Buddhism it's called wrathful compassion even, you know, those kind of deities with fire coming out of their heads. And, I think Nikki's presentation today, the corpse presentation, was fierce compassion. It's an aspect of compassion that's very courageous and aligns with the truth. And sometimes truth is difficult. I used to sit... for many years, I sat for 6 weeks, the last half of the three-month retreat at the Forest Refuge, and there was a couple. I was young, and there was an older at that time, and there was an older couple. I actually knew the man was the oldest person there because they had a ceremony at the end every year where the youngest and the oldest person would speak. And one morning, after the instructional set, this man, I think his name was Henry, raised his hand. And he said to the teacher, it was Guy Armstrong, I've been coming here for years. I loved sitting, love walking, and now, love being in the woods. And now that I'm old, all of those things are really hard for me. What should I do? And this is what Guy said, are you familiar with the Buddhist teachings of the five remembrances? This is what they are. I am subject to aging, have not gone beyond aging. I am subject to illness, have not gone beyond illness. I am subject to death, have not gone beyond death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbiter. Whatever I do, for good or for evil, to that I will fall heir. And as a young person, I heard Guy say that, and I was like, can't you come up with something better than that? You know, I really wanted him to just, like, make Henry feel better. And, you know, that wasn't a wholesome instinct, really. It really wasn't compassion. It was a kind of false compassion, because we are, we're all subject to the truth of the way things are. And the only way we can get comfortable and relaxed in this life is to get comfortable and relaxed with reality. And this is something that mindfulness of death teaches us. I'd like to read a poem by Mary Howe, who lost her brother to AIDS. The last time we had dinner together in a restaurant with white tablecloths, he leaned forward and took my two hands in his hands and said, I'm going to die soon. I want you to know that. And I said, I think I do know. And he said, what surprises me is that you don't. And I said, I do. And he said, what? And I said, know that you're going to die. And he said, no, I mean, know that you are. You know, it's really hard for us to remember, to really remember. Unless we are willing to have the courageous compassion to practice mindfulness of death. So one thing I did want to do tonight, and I think there's still time, is just do a little self-compassion practice. There are some universal ways, you know, that researchers say that we can experience compassion. And one of them is compassionate touch. That it's a universal experience for a human being to feel compassion expressed through touch. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone does, because our upbringings and trainings can kind of have, you know, muted that capacity. But if we practice it, it comes back. And I thought about doing it because of, you know, the discussion that I shared about the difference between the word compassion and the feeling of compassion. So I'd just like to try it. It'll only take a few minutes. I'm going to offer various ways to practice it, and with the hope that one of them resonates with you. And then, you know, you can have it in your toolbox for practice. But when we do it, I'd like people to close their eyes because, you know, just feel less self-conscious with nobody watching you. Yeah, just taking a moment to drop into the body. And soften the eyes. And almost like you're dialing in an old-fashioned radio to attune to the experience of sensation, sensations in the body. And then place a hand on your chest, the center of your chest, sometimes called the spiritual heart. Just feeling the contact there. The way we might touch our hearts when we say to ourselves, oh, this is hard. Be feeling the rise and fall of your breath against your hand. And have a way of saying without words, I see you, I care about you, I'm here with you. And then placing both hands, one on top of the other, on the chest, a little different. As if you're embracing yourself with kindness, compassion. And sometimes gently rocking can soothe and ease the body. Softening, receiving this touch of compassion. Taking a few breaths while you're being held. Then releasing your hands, just feeling if there's been any shift. Then placing a hand on your face and cradling your cheek. A gesture of intimacy and affection. Way of coming close. Being a friend. Then placing both hands on your cheek. Cradling your face like you might cradle the face of a child or a pet. Saying without words, I care about you, I see you. I know sometimes it's hard. Then releasing your hands again and just feeling the echo, the legacy of compassion in the body. Now stroking your arm with your opposite hand, like you might stroke a pet that's sitting on your lap, rhythmic and soothing, gentle. Now holding your thumb with, or your finger, with the opposite fingers, like a child holds a parent's hand. Of making a circle of connection. Offering support. Then let's end with a hand on the belly and a hand on the chest. Holding this living, breathing body with care and compassion. Now releasing the hands and just most feeling the breath like an inner touch. Breath, like fingertips of awareness, soothing the body. And when you're ready, you can take a few deeper breaths and just gently open your eyes. So as I said, you know, there are many different practices and some resonate with us and others don't. But for many people, this practice of compassionate touch can really it's very effective in kind of shifting our being towards more kindness and gentleness, a kind of felt sense. So I'm just going to end with a little story. It's a story about a samurai and a monk, Zen monk. And in these stories, the samurai represents worldly power. Now, I actually saw some samurai costumes. You know, they're embroidered, and the sword has jewels and a big hat. And he comes to this, you know, monk with his robes and begging bowl who represents inner power. And he said to the monk, "Tell me everything you know about heaven and hell." The monk looks up at him and says, "You lowly worm, what makes you think you could understand everything I know about heaven and hell?" So the samurai reaches for his sword because he was insulted by the monk and he's going to cut off his head. And the monk says, "That's hell." And then the samurai is really touched. Wow, this monk has courage. The courage to speak, you know, truth. You know, to offer me this act of compassion. Gets tears in his eyes. And the monk says, "And that's heaven." So, you know, we all have an inner samurai and an inner monk. And and practice is getting more familiar with our inner monk. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.